Welcome to our continuing video series, In Self-Defense. Hi, I'm Don West, National Trial Counsel for CCW Safe, here with Sean Vincent, litigation consultant and author.
An author.
You think I threw that in?
I like it.
You wrote some of the...
When Don says author, he means he means that I've been writing for the CCW website about self-defense cases that have made the headlines. And we're looking at them for lessons for concealed carriers or for homeowners interested in home defense. What went right? What went wrong in these cases? And they really illustrate where the line is. You know, what is self-defense and what's murder, right?
And sometimes the best lesson is those that are learned from, if not your own experience, other people's experience. And I think part of what we're doing here is examining in some detail some cases, pretty high profile. Many of our viewers may have been aware of these cases, maybe not in the detail that we will talk about them, but in enough detail to be familiar with the basic facts. And that we hope through these discussions and sharing our thoughts and assessment to come up with something that's of value.
Yeah. So we've looked first at self-defense cases that took place in the home, Castle Doctrine cases. And we looked at a case of Marcus Karma in Montana and Byron Smith in Minnesota. And one thing that both of these cases had in common was that the homeowner had sort of lured in or invited an invasion. They'd been broken into before. They were upset about this. And they created a situation where it was likely that they'd have to defend themselves.
Well, sure. I think that, as you say, in both of those instances, with prior burglaries and prior thefts, they had individually concluded they were done with that.
Sure.
They didn't want to live in fear of the theft or fear of their own safety, and took several clear steps to create an opportunity for this thing to happen one last time.
Sure. And by the time we were done discussing those cases, it seems pretty clear that the convictions that they got were reasonable, that they weren't justifiable self-defense cases. And we did that on purpose because it showed a lot of people operate with the idea that if someone breaks into your house, you're justified in using deadly force to meet them. And it's not
no matter
always,
what the circumstances.
Right, and it's not always the case. And the extreme circumstances is if you've lured them into your house and you had planned on an encounter with your gun
and
in the first place.
And you ambushed them.
Sure,
without any other threat assessment. Yes, you can easily take what in most circumstances would be a self-defense scenario and quickly turn it into the act of murder.
Sure, but now we're looking at a case where that's not so clear. We're going to go to Dearborn Heights outside of Detroit, Michigan. It's November of 2013, and I'm going to tell the story from the point of view of Ted Wafer. He lives alone. He's a mechanic out at the airport. He had fallen asleep watching television in his Dearborn Heights home. It's a home that he'd owned for a long time. The neighborhood between 2013 and 1994 when he bought it had changed. Crime was up. He wakes up a little before 4 in the morning to this massive pounding on the side door of his house. He said it was so loud that the floorboards were shaking. And it was so insistent that he couldn't imagine it was made by just one person. He thought there were two or more people trying to get into his house.
And he's awakened from a sound sleep.
That's right.
By this pounding noise. So I assume he's both startled and confused initially.
I think that's fair to say, right? Mm-hmm. He looked for a cell phone. He couldn't find his cell phone. He grabs his shotgun instead, right? And this is a tactical shotgun that holds multiple rounds.
That he acknowledged at some point he acquired for home defense.
He'd bought it about 6 years in advance, I think partly in concern that his neighborhood was becoming more prone to crime. The banging on the door starts on the side, it moves around to his front door. He goes to his front door, he looks through the peephole, he sees a shadowy figure, is how he testified. And then he opens up the door. The locked door, he opens it up.
Well, describe, I think as I understand it, there is a solid locked door.
Right.
And immediately outside, before the porch, is a less sturdy typical screen door.
A locked screen door.
So there are two doors. The first one's the screen door, locked, but not particularly sturdy.
Right.
And then the solid front door that would take some considerable effort to break through.
Right. He opens the door, and then a moment later, he's fired his shotgun. The number four shot goes through the locked screen door and into the head of what turned out to be 19-year-old Renisha McBride, killing her instantly, and she falls dead on his porch. When he describes it, when he opened the door, she was erratic and started pushing in through the screen, and he felt as though she was trying to get in the house. And so now, here's a larger context for the story. Renisha McBride, 19, a year before, was a high school student, a cheerleader at the local high school. She had been out playing drinking games and smoking marijuana with a friend. She left at a certain point after they had an argument, and about 1:30 a.m. in the morning, with her blood alcohol level when she was tested after the shooting was 0.22, which is nearly three times the legal limit to drive.
Sure. That's very intoxicating.
So that means before that, she was even more intoxicated. She'd mm-hmm. involved in a single, she ran into another car that was parked, had injured her head by all accounts. And then between that and 3 hours later or more, when she shows up at Ted Wafer's house, nobody knows where she was. So she's obviously injured, she's intoxicated, she's disoriented, and nobody knows why she was banging on the door at Ted Wafer's house, but the assumption is that she either mistook it for mm-hmm. a friend's house or was looking for help. And
it's unlikely that she was trying to break in to steal things. Unlikely that she was trying to invade the home as a robber to confront or hurt the occupant. But of course, none of that would be known to Mr. Wafer.
He couldn't know.
He was on the other side of the door, had no idea who this person was, what led up to her. Probably didn't know the person was a female, may have, but initially all he heard was enough pounding to wake him up out of his sleep. Mm-hmm. And make him curious as just what the heck was going on.
And very specifically, he didn't know if it was male or female. And in fact, when he testified at trial, he said he just couldn't imagine, even now, that all that noise was being made by mm-hmm. a woman. Mm-hmm. So here's the setup. This is clearly nothing like the last two cases that we've talked about in regards to. If they were expecting someone to come, Ted Wafer certainly was not expecting Renisha McBride to show up on his porch that night. Mm-hmm. And we start out our exploration of these cases with the location of the shooting, right? And in these first three cases, they're all Holman cases, Castle mm-hmm. Doctrine cases. What makes that important in this case? We've got a shooting on the threshold of a house. Does that make a difference that she was outside a locked screen door in this particular case?
I don't think it makes a legal difference as to whether she was on his property or in his property. I don't think it matters in terms of the Castle Doctrine. Assuming that otherwise he would have to retreat before he could use deadly force, I don't think the fact that she hadn't actually entered the home makes any legal difference in that regard. It's still his home, it's still where he is protected, it's still where he is not legally required to run before facing a bona fide threat and responding. Other than that, every big case is often, many big cases are often decided on little facts. And the idea that she hadn't actually come in the house may be relevant on other issues. The fact that he opened the door, creating an opportunity for this face-to-face, is another big issue. But I don't think just because she was not actually physically in the house, I still think the Castle Doctrine would apply as a legal principle, because she was clearly on his property and had taken clear steps to evince an interest in entering the house.
Sure. And we've talked for each one of these cases about the idea that you're never given more benefit of the doubt as a shooter in a self-defense case than when you're in your own home. And to lose that benefit, there has to be other things that went wrong.
Sure, this isn't a situation where he heard noises outside and exited his house, went out into the street, and confronted someone who was being wild and crazy and aggressive.
Right.
This person came to him in his house.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night, sure.
So the next element in the case that we're going to look at is de-escalation. We talk about escalation and de-escalation as something that's present and variable in every self-defense case that we look at. And in this case, we were just talking about how that threat was brought to him. He didn't know it was a 19-year-old girl who had been in a car accident and was drunk and high. What he knows is that it's in the middle of the night. He's woken to banging. It sounds like someone's trying to get in mm-hmm. his house. As his defense attorney said in trial, someone's trying to get into your house. It's not to help you. It's to hurt you.
Yes, and of course the larger context is what you mentioned earlier. He's living in a neighborhood that, from his view, was in transition, mm-hmm. and that he felt the need some years before to be able to protect himself just under these, what he thought were these kinds of circumstances. He bought a gun. He kept it at home. He had it available if, in fact, something like this occurred.
Now, at trial, the prosecutor suggests that there are a number of other things that he could have done besides go to the front door with a shotgun and fire. And one of those things is he could have called 911, right? Now, the defense attorney said that he couldn't find his phone. He eventually, immediately following the shooting, did call 911. It was in the pocket of his jeans, which were hanging on the bathroom door.
You know, these kinds of self-defense isn't very complicated, but that doesn't make it very easy when you're trying to analyze this.
Sure.
He could have done lots of different things. The fact that he didn't call 911 isn't against the law. It was a bad decision, but it wasn't against the law. The fact that he wound up opening the door that actually put him at higher risk than he would have been had he just left the door shut isn't against the law, but it was a really bad tactical decision. He, in a sense, this escalation idea, it wasn't that he was provoking a fight or provoking the confrontation, but he had some pretty obvious things he could have done that would have helped avoid it until he had a much clearer idea of what was actually going on.
Sure.
I don't think, from what I remember about the case, that there were even words spoken. For example, who are you? What do you want?
Yeah,
even to
correct.
The point of, I have a gun. Stand back. Don't come in. Anything that may have shifted the balance of what was going on enough for him to be able to realistically assess, was he in danger? Or was this one of those wild, crazy episodes with the drunken frat boy pounding on the door? Or in this instance, the injured motorist who is seeking help and may have, as a combination of intoxication and head injury and confusion and such, not even considered the risk that she was taking herself by pounding on some guy's door in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So prosecutors at trial, you talk about this creating a circumstance by opening the door to invite the confrontation. He brought that up during his closing arguments in this case. And he was charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter in this case. And I want to talk about manslaughter right now because on that charge, right, he basically suggested Ted Wafer was negligent when that he created the opportunity where this deadly confrontation might happen when he mm-hmm. didn't call him and when he opened the door. Let's talk about opening this front door. It seems sort of inexplicable at this point.
It's perplexing, isn't it, that under these circumstances, and I'm assuming from the way it's been described, that some time had passed from the first awakening from the banging on the door until the door was opened.
It's really enough time for him to look for his cell phone, not find it, go grab his shotgun.
Be awake. Not, it wasn't a knee-jerk reaction to open the door, it doesn't sound like. Is there any explanation from him? I know he testified, mm-hmm. and of course in most self-defense cases, the accused has to testify in order to get enough evidence before the jury on self-defense that the jury, that the prosecutor has to disprove it. That's sort of the mm-hmm. procedural process that once an accused or a defendant puts on evidence of self-defense, the prosecutor has to prove it wasn't. But unless there is that evidence, then the defense is not, there's no jury instruction, the defense isn't offered. So usually it means that the defendant or the accused has to testify. Once he or she takes the stand, of course, they are subject to full cross-examination.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then if it's not a sound self-defense scenario, or frankly, if the accused isn't a very good witness for lots of reasons other than they simply aren't telling the truth, they may not be very good at expressing themselves, they may get nervous, they may misspeak and have to explain, there may very well be some inconsistent statements given in the past that can be exploited. It's a very dangerous thing from a trial lawyer's perspective to put any witness on the stand, much less the defendant in a criminal case. However, a defendant usually has to testify.
Especially when it's an affirmative defense.
Yes, and Mr. Wafer did.
He did.
So, did he offer any credible explanation that you're aware of why he opened that?
Without the benefit of having been able to see the trial, we mm-hmm. rely on what multiple reporting sources did. And in those sources, it never came up, a justification for opening the door. And part of that is because there is a more serious issue that we'll get to in a minute that he had to confront under testimony. But while we're talking about escalation and de-escalation, in Castle Doctrine cases, one of the issues, themes that we've been exploring is the idea of, in the Karma case, a deputy told them after their first break-in that their house is a target of opportunity because they leave the mm-hmm. garage door open at night, it's dark. It comes up in trial that during the cross-examination of Ted Wafer that he didn't have a security system, and if he's concerned about the crime in the neighborhood, why does he buy a tactical shotgun instead of a security system? He says everyone would like to have a security system, but he couldn't afford it. This may not have convicted him, but is someone putting themselves at increased liability if they don't have a security system and they have a gun for home defense instead?
It's not against the law not to have a security system, just like it's not against the law to have a firearm for home protection. However, in that scenario, there's more explaining to do, I would think. He would almost have to do, as you suggest, he would almost have to explain why he chose to have a gun instead of a security system, if that was, in fact, what his thinking was. Mm-hmm. That's only, it doesn't make much sense or much difference legally, except that any little twist and turn in this is something that the jury might hang on to and say, you know, this really wasn't what we thought it was. This isn't really the homeowner who's being attacked who had to defend himself. Maybe this is a homeowner who was looking for an opportunity, who wanted to clean up the neighborhood. Any manner of misinterpretation.
Or had simply missed too many opportunities to mm-hmm. de-escalate as to have created the circumstance where deadly force was
used.
And
I think this is a layering effect. You take the fact that he didn't in fact find his cell phone. He knew he owned one. Mm-hmm. He knew it was somewhere in there, and that he didn't make the effort to call the police or even yell out, frankly, that he went to the door with the gun, which actually makes logical sense until you open the door
right. And
create an opportunity face to face with someone that you can't believe is raising that much of a ruckus. They're obviously trying pretty hard to get in your house, and you create the scenario where you're face-to-face with
them. And all this goes to, you talk about the decisions that the jury are going to have to make. What they're going to be asked to do is decide, was the use of lethal force reasonable, right? And was his fear of imminent harm reasonable? So our third element in these self-defense cases is is reasonable fear. Mm-hmm. And in this case, woken out of a sound sleep with what sounds like someone trying to get into your house aggressively with banging, and the fear is not unreasonable, or at least we talk about different types of fear. It's reasonable to think that he'd be afraid in his home alone at this point.
Well, not only afraid, but under those circumstances, reasonably believe that someone was trying to get in under circumstances that most likely meant they weren't there to deliver a package or Girl Scout cookies. You know, somebody sure. wanted to get in and was insistent.
Yeah.
So, yes, all of that fits into this reasonable fear notion. However, the reasonableness has to extend beyond all of the acts that lead up to and include the decision for the lethal self-defense.
Sure, and I think this is a good time to bring up what may be the biggest problem for Ted Wafer in his defense in this case, which is when he opens up the door, the shotgun goes off, and it hits Renisha McBride in the head, and she dies immediately. He told the police when they arrived that he didn't know the gun was loaded, and it just went off, right? And if his defense is that he was in fear for his life, and at trial, when he testifies, he says it was either them or me, and he checks the boxes, right? He says the things mm-hmm. that you're supposed to say, and fear is certainly plausible here, but he'd undermine that argument by saying that it was an accident, essentially.
He told two inconsistent stories and then chose the one he wanted the jury to believe. That is easy pickings. That's the low-hanging fruit for an effective prosecutor. When you have someone who is presenting you with inconsistent defenses. Factually, if you really dissected this, it may not be all that inconsistent, but the way it was presented, especially if he said, I didn't know it was loaded and mm-hmm. it went off by accident, he's saying that the act of firing the gun was unintentional. Self-defense in the face of an imminent threat of serious bodily harm or death requires an intentional act response. That's what self-defense is. You are facing a threat to your life that warrants legally and factually a response up to and including lethal force. I don't think you can have it both ways. What I can't figure out is what on earth he was thinking at the point that he opened the door. Was he thinking that if he stood there with the gun, under the first story, an unloaded gun, that mm-hmm. he didn't intend to fire, would that scare them off? Would that back them away? And then it would be over. If so, why open the door? That just doesn't make sense to me. On right. the other hand, if you open the door with a gun that you know is loaded, and you have the ability to fire, and this goes to the escalation idea, that
right.
you have created a more likely scenario where you will wind up firing. And frankly, it's probably not against the law to open the door in that scenario. It's really stupid, a really mm-hmm. stupid thing to do. It's not against the law to do it. It's your own house. And it's probably not against the law under those facts even to stand there with a gun, because someone has come on your property, is clearly trying to make noise and get in. And I think under those facts, you can assume that their acts are unlawful and that you're at risk. But then to shoot somebody through a closed screen door, I think is where the line crosses. And it's at the point where he may very well have been so confused at the beginning as to exactly what happened that he may not even have been intentionally lying. He may have not thought it through well enough to be able to reconstruct it, that he knew what was going on in his mind.
Sure.
He could piece some of it together, and he said probably the first thing that he thought was exculpatory, that would get him off the hook.
Sure, so we move now into this fourth element that we explore, these post-incident actions. And in this mm-hmm. particular case, He's fired the shotgun, one blast, it's killed Renisha McBride. She's dead in a pool of her own blood on his front porch. He's able to find his cell phone now. He calls 911. It's a brief call. He explains that he shot somebody who was trying to get into his house with his shotgun. It's a real flat phone call. His affect is very flat, and he hangs up before even able to give the operator his address. But of course, they're able to track that, and they were able to find him. Or they called back, I believe, and actually came back and found him. So he's called 911. He's reported himself, which is an important issue that we come up with. Somebody's going to call 911 eventually. Uh-huh. Marcus Karma's wife, his common-law wife, called the cops immediately following the shooting. In the Smith case, it's a whole day later where his neighbor calls the police on him after he makes a unusual phone call to his neighbor asking for advice on a lawyer.
Because he doesn't want to bother the police on Thanksgiving Day.
Sure. Right. So in this case, Ted Wafer suffered. He did the right thing. He got law enforcement involved right away. And now he makes what ends up being really a critical mistake for him. He gives them statements without the advice of an attorney. He says the things that he'll later have to refute at trial.
We've talked about this before, that even under the best of circumstances with the most innocent of defenders, it's extremely difficult to give a cogent, consistent, frankly, exculpatory explanation. You want it to be exculpatory because your goal is explaining why you acted in self-defense. The problem is when you say something stupid or something that's inconsistent with other evidence, or that you make mistakes because you get the sequence out of order, or you basically are suffering the effects of the trauma on yourself in being able to construct an accurate statement, you have magnified tenfold the problems that you will have down the road.
And so at trial, after closing arguments, the judge giving the jury instructions actually instructs the jury that they're allowed to interpret the conflicting statements as a sign of guilt. That trying to make exculpatory statements that ended up being false could be interpreted by the jury as a sign of guilt.
And that's not uncommon. In many jurisdictions, a false exculpatory statement is an indicia of guilt. You hear that kind of stuff, and it's absolutely devastating to a defense. Any inconsistent statement has to be explained. Some of them can be, because we're humans and we make mistakes. But an intentionally false exculpatory statement that's shown to be, in fact, by definition, false,
sure,
is a huge mountain to climb.
Sure. If false by your own, you know, he testified at trial, the opposite. Exactly. So there's no way to back down.
Yeah, and then
on
he's
that.
Asking the jury to acquit him because he acted legally.
Yeah. Looking back on the case, the defense attorney, Cheryl Carpenter, was incredulous, really, that she lost. She was asked by a reporter after the verdict came in, guilty, second degree, guilty manslaughter, that she couldn't believe that he's convicted for this. Uh-huh. A man in his home, and by all accounts, he's a good guy, right? And in fact, they go back to sentencing, and he makes a statement that he's going to live with the guilt and remorse for the shooting that he regrets for the rest of his life. And the judge says that she has no doubt that he's remorseful about it, but the fact is that she suspects he panicked, right, and did the wrong thing. And in his own testimony, he says that he was scared and he was panicked. And it seems very much like without malice. The judge even says that here's someone who's an otherwise law-abiding citizen who committed homicide in a moment of panic and confusion. And that might be the tragic truth of this case. Is here's a man who's not a murderer in his heart. He didn't go to that front door with
exactly.
malice.
Right. And he probably didn't have much training, certainly no experience. He'd never been in the military that I know of or had any law enforcement training. Mm-hmm. And he got over his head immediately, made some bad decisions, exercised some poor judgment in how he handled this thing as it unfolded. And then, of course, it may be entirely possible that he reacted unintentionally when he pulled the trigger. She may have startled him. It's evident she seemed to have attempted to get in even then through the screen door. He was very in close proximity there. And there may have been some almost involuntary reflex, maybe completely involuntary, where he winds up pulling the trigger before he had planned to.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a criminal offense. That's at least manslaughter under that scenario.
Yeah.
I think it is. Well, it's very close.
Well, it's up to a jury,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the other little elements play into whether a jury's going to forgive you you said before about the Castle Doctrine and shootings in your own home that even if you don't do things perfectly, if a jury can put themselves in your shoes and they believe your fear, that you might get the benefit of the doubt even if you've made a mistake, and that a negligent manslaughter claim might be forgiven.
Maybe so.
Not for certain, but there's a better chance of it.
But this thing transitioned because it became a presentation of self-defense. And that may also have been a plausible presentation if it had been consistent. But he wound up having the worst of both worlds. He had an imperfect self-defense claim because of his prior statements.
Mm-hmm.
And he frankly had an imperfect claim on manslaughter, or maybe even that might have resulted in some jury nullification if they felt bad for him under the circumstances when he complicated it the other way. You know, Cheryl Carpenter enjoys a terrific reputation. She's an excellent trial lawyer, and I think she, as you mentioned, really agonized over this. And I think she demonstrated how hard these cases can be, especially when two people without criminal records, where there's no malice and evil intent starting off, their paths cross, and a tragedy occurs.
Somebody loses their life, somebody wavers in jail for, you got 15 years for the charges, and they added 2 years for the felony of using a gun for it.
You know, we've now talked about three of these home invasion type cases, Carmen, Smith, and this one. And what has now resonated with me that I hadn't thought so much about is that in each one, there was no real attempt to address this sort of gray area of what was really going on just prior to the fatal shots. We talked about it as escalation, but mm-hmm. what I'm really talking about is that the person who wound up defending never said anything or did anything to clarify exactly what was going on, to clarify that, in fact, there was a threat that needed to be addressed by doing those things that might have run them off, or doing those things in this wafer case that might have clarified this is a drunk young girl who is in the wrong place. And anything like that that would have allowed Ted Wafer to understand that he wasn't about to be assaulted in his own home would have changed the entire course of this. Just like it would have in the Smith case, if he had done something to run these kids off or not invite them to the moment of their death. And even in the Karma case, it seemed clear that the guy that was trying to steal the beer had no intention to harm him. But the Smith and the Karma cases really look like setup type cases.
Mm-hmm.
People, in their mind, legally defending their own home, but they weren't legally defending. And then now in the Wafer case, just a tragic set of circumstances that
destroyed two people's lives plus their families.
Mm-hmm.
So lessons here, right? And none of these cases did anyone call 911 beforehand. And you've talked about things that you're not legally required to do, right? But if you're interested in avoiding a circumstance where you'll have to use your gun in self-defense, then a lot of these scenarios run differently. If they, or if, God forbid, you do have to use your gun in self-defense, it'll be that much more justifiable if you've called 911.
And you can articulate the reasons why. And they will be credible reasons that you have, in fact, done everything you could do to avoid the lethal confrontation.
Right, but if you can look a jury in the eye at testimony and say, I called 911, I turned the porch light on, I asked them to identify what their purpose was, I hit the panic button on my security system to make this racket that
whatever
would scare them
reasonable
away.
Things you can do that doesn't increase the risk to yourself, mm-hmm. that can help clarify the situation and avoid, you do them. And if you aren't successful or you run out of time and you have a bona fide threat to your life, then obviously you have to take those steps then.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. I'm Sean Vincent. This is Don West. This is our series, In Self-Defense. Thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you.